This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 14th of September 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tyler Brulé. Coming up over the next 60 minutes, we'll be talking about the unfolding situation at Western embassies across the Middle East and North Africa. We'll be speaking to David Anderson, Professor of African Politics at Oxford University, in a moment. And we'll be jumping across the Atlantic to talk to the Independent's David Usborne about the Fed's move to inject another round of funds to stimulate the economy. And here in studio, we'll be getting a Gallic view on those pictures of the Duchess of Cambridge that have appeared in Closer magazine in France. And as it's Friday, we'll also have our editor Andrew Tuck and foreign editor Steve Bloomfield to review the week's main stories. In fact, they're in studio now. Steve, what are we going to be chatting about?
Mainly the Middle East and the attacks on the embassies and also the response in the US.
Andrew?
Yes, we're going to be looking at that in some depth and looking at what it means for the embassies around the world.
And if that's not enough, we'll be joined in studio also by our Ed Stalker as he arrives back from the protests in Argentina. All that, plus we meet our Jewish neighbours, and maybe we'll squeeze in a song or two right here on Midori House, live from London, on Monocle 24. And welcome to a blustery Friday here in London, outside of Midori House. We have much to get through over the next 59 minutes here, but first is over to Bill Bingham with the hour's headlines.
Monocle 24 News at 1800 hours. I'm Bill Bingham. Protests against a US film said to mock Islam have escalated in North Africa, the Middle East, the subcontinent, and the Far East. Demonstrators have attacked Western embassies in Tunisia and Sudan. In Khartoum, protesters entered the US compound, while the German and UK embassies were also attacked. In Tunis, a cloud of black smoke has been seen over the US embassy compound, and police have fired warning shots. There were also clashes in Yemen and Egypt. In the Lebanese city of Tripoli, one person has been killed when demonstrators set fire to a KFC fast food restaurant. Hundreds of protesters in Pakistan have been burning American flags, and angry protesters have been marching through Jordan's capital, Amman, demanding the US government stop the distribution of the film, which is said to insult Mohammed. The authorities in Libya have made a number of arrests over the attack on the US consulate in Benghazi on Tuesday, which killed the US ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans. Speaking to United Nations General Assembly meeting on the culture of peace, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said there was no justification for the killing and brutality. For many Muslims, any depiction of the Prophet is blasphemous. US probation officers are still looking into potential violations of prison release terms by a California man linked to the anti-Islam film. Authorities in southern India have stepped up security after hundreds of anti-nuclear protesters escalated their fight against the country's largest Kudankulam nuclear power project. Demonstrators formed a human chain in waist-deep seawater, demanding an end to the loading of fuel in the plant. Protest intensified after the Supreme Court's decision against suspension of loading of fuel into the nuclear reactor. International lenders are likely to reach a final decision on the revised financing programme for Greece in the second half of October. Inspectors from the so-called Troika of the International Monetary Fund, European Commission and ECB are in Athens to evaluate Greece's progress on agreed targets before releasing the next €32 billion from a €130 billion aid package. Cash-strapped Greece must come up with nearly €12 billion in extra cuts for the next 2 years to get the money, and it's fallen behind in reforms. Wildcat strikers at Lonmin's Marikana mine have rejected a pay offer, dimming prospects of ending 5 weeks of industrial action that swept through South Africa's platinum sector and laid bare the power struggle in the ruling ANC. Workers on a rocky outcrop at the mine, where police shot dead 34 protesters last month, have dismissed the offer as way below the 12,500 rand a month, that's around $1,500, sought by members of the Militant Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union. The hole in the ozone layer, the Earth's protective shield against ultraviolet rays, is expected to be smaller this year over the Antarctic than last year. UN officials say it shows how a ban on harmful substances has stopped its depletion. but they say the hole is probably larger than in 2010, and a complete recovery is still a long way off. The UN Weather Agency says the signing of the Montreal Protocol 25 years ago to phase out chemicals that deplete the ozone layer has helped prevent millions of cases of skin cancer and eye cataracts, as well as harmful effects on the environment. And that's the latest Monocle 24 news.
Thanks very much for that, Bill. It is at just 21:05 if you're listening in Dubai, 18:05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle
24. Shandai, Efrognewit, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Well, further to our bulletin, protests are raging across North Africa, indeed much of the Muslim world, at various Western embassies. The U.S. compound in Cairo has been under siege for 4 days. Protesters have just been expelled from the U.S. embassy in Khartoum, and they're also in front of the British embassy. Across the city, the German embassy is in flames. Well, with all of this sparked by a film that has depicted the Prophet Muhammad in an unfavorable light, how can the situation be diffused? Well, for more on this, we're joined on the line by David Anderson at Oxford University. Hello, Mr. Anderson.
Hello.
I guess if one is sitting at various foreign ministries in major Western capitals, it's going to be a very long weekend. I mean, aside from just how does one shore up defenses, but I guess, you know, the bigger issue right now, you know, how does actually one, you know, attempt to put a lid on things?
Well, I think that the worry that everyone has is that there is an organizing hand behind some, at least some of this, certainly not all of it. And I think that's the most worrying thing, that there seems to be now a systematic targeting of embassies. And that needs to be clamped down on very hard. Of course, you know, the European and North American governments who are being targeted are going to have to depend upon their friends in these countries to sort this out. Course of action available to them.
Right. And when you talk about friends in these regions, who would one, you know, be specifically looking to? Is this, as we've seen of late, you know, does all of this sort of fall on, or much of it fall on the shoulders of Doha, or where does this land?
I think you've got to look to the governments in Cairo and in Libya in particular, but also to groups in other countries who have been involved in good progressive dialogue with the West over the last 18 months. I think that if the Arab Spring effect is going to mean anything, then this situation is a real test for it. Can those who wish to bring greater democratic forces to bear in these countries, can they handle this kind of situation? It's a real test for them. And I think it's not clear that they can. You know, in Libya, the situation really is very difficult for the government. They don't want this happening. It's the last thing they need. Similarly, in Cairo, situation in Khartoum is very different, where I think the government there may well be smiling quite gleefully at what has happened. This is a poke in the eye for the Americans, who they've not been very happy with. So they might do rather less about it. But in countries where the West has been involved in assisting the Arab Spring, this is not what those new incumbent governments want.
Of any of the countries you're talking about, is one more symbolic than another? So, you know, if we see a situation where, you know, things really come under control, you know, in Egypt, and forces from within, as you're saying, you know, manage to actually, you know, put enough cold water on all of this, do others fall into line? Or if you look south to Khartoum, does that situation continue to rage and spill elsewhere?
I wish there were a barometer country and I could say to you, yes, if it gets sorted there, it'll be fine. But I'm afraid there just isn't. The situations in each of these countries, Yemen, Sudan, Egypt, Lebanon, and Libya, and also now Tunisia, they are all radically different from one another. It is impossible to see them as being linked in these policy terms. So I think this increases the difficulty, because each of these situations has to be negotiated bilaterally. you can be sure that people are working very, very hard right now to sort this out. In Khartoum, I think, and in Yemen, it's different than in Egypt and Libya, and perhaps also Tunisia. Because in Cairo and Yemen, I think it is much more difficult for these situations to be controlled. In Sudan, because the government perhaps doesn't want to control it, and in Yemen, because the situation is so inflammatory, and there is such a major presence of armed groups who are very opposed to the Americans, that it's easy to see how that situation can get out of hand.
Do you think this has caught some Western governments a bit on the back foot? Of course, compounds in potentially volatile countries are always going to be on some state of alert. But if you're sitting in Berlin, do you think they're slightly surprised? I'm looking at Der Spiegel's coverage right now. I mean, you have a compound which is in flames right now. So if you're the foreign ministry in Berlin, has this caught them by surprise that they're pulled into what was certainly seen as an American story to start?
It has caught them by surprise, and it's also caught the Americans by surprise. And the Americans will be asking some very serious questions of themselves about the security in Benghazi, because clearly something went badly wrong there. And I think that the story that might emerge there is that was not a spontaneous incident. That was planned and organized, and it was done by groups who wished to target that embassy. Elsewhere, it might be more of a mixture of spontaneity, a public reaction to what's gone on, and also some degree of organization. But Germany and other European governments will be a little surprised to being caught up in this. But it really, we ought to analyze the Arab Spring a little bit more pragmatically. These countries are going to take a very long time to stabilize. They're very heavily armed, their people are poor, they are very discontent. And the other thing to remember is that they know that for the last 50 years, it was Western support that kept dictator governments in power.
Mm.
They're not going to forget that just because of the Arab Spring. So we have a long road to hoe here. This is not going to be over anytime soon.
Just before we go, is it perhaps a series of somewhat interrelated forces that are behind all of this, or does it actually really sort of filter up and eventually point to one group, do you think, David?
I don't think it does point to one group. I think in each of these countries you have political forces, right of center, who do not like the influence of globalization, and especially Western variants of globalization, on their culture and their society. They are going to take political opportunities to make currency against what they see as this foreign imperialism that is still evident. It's noticeable that in Egypt it's foreign restaurants that have been attacked in some places, not just embassies and political sites. So this is about a sense of cultural domination as well as political domination. And that makes it extremely difficult to deal with in purely political terms.
David Anderson, Professor of African Studies at Oxford University, thanks for that. When we come back in a moment, we're going to be looking at the Fed's latest injection of funds into the U.S. economy. We'll be talking to David Osborne. Stay with us.
The Venice Architecture Biennale is a heady place to take the temperature of the industry and a good place to forecast its future. Monocle Films was there to do both.
As the industry flocked to Venice for the 13th Architecture Biennale, it was greeted by a storm of biblical proportions, which rolled into the lagoon out of nowhere. Even the greatest cynic pondered if this might be punishment for previous gaudy, expensive, ego-driven projects. But even these clouds had silver linings. As they tumbled away, they revealed a Venice that looked better than ever.
Architecture on film. In the programs menu on monocle.com.
If you're on the go but still want to stay tuned in to Monocle 24, then download the Monocle mobile phone app. You'll have access to our live stream, past shows, Monocle's daily web column, and our 2525 city guides. And it's available for iPhone, Windows Phone 7, and Nokia N9 devices. So take Monocle 24 with you wherever you are, whether you're beachside or airborne. Head to monocle.com for more details.
And And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's at 2:15 if you are listening in Seoul, 19:15 in Madrid, 18:15 here in London. Well, America's latest attempt to pull itself out of the economic mire has become the latest political football in an increasingly fraught election campaign. Ben Bernanke's decision to go ahead with a third round of quantitative easing, or as you could say, printing money, has been criticized by the Republicans. Lanny Chen, Mitt Romney's campaign policy director, has said, quote, after 4 years of stagnant growth, falling incomes, rising costs, and persistently high unemployment, the American economy doesn't need more artificial and ineffective measures. We should be creating wealth, not printing dollars. He went on to say that it was further confirmation that President Obama's policies have not worked. Well, joining us now on the line is the Independence U.S. editor, Mr. David Osborne. Hello, David.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you? It's fascinating to be looking at this because, we have two, perhaps, very pointed arrows suddenly, you know, staring down at the Obama administration. Of course, our piece earlier on various, U.S., embassy compounds, under siege. And of course, we've seen the shots that the Republicans have been taking at it. And then, of course, we've got this news, around Bernanke now as well. How is this playing? And I'm specifically talking about this QE3. How is this playing on U.S. screens and at the moment?
Well, honestly, I think that the Fed action is pretty non-controversial. I think if you were to go out on the Main Street USA and ask people whether they welcome the Fed trying to do something to kickstart the economy, you're not going to find many people, except for the sort of diehard Tea Party folks, who will say, no, don't do it. Because, if it does what it's meant to do, which is make it easier to refinance homes, make it easier to borrow money, make it easier to export goods as the dollar comes down a little bit, then, surely that's going to be something that most people will welcome. I mean, the Republicans, of course, are using it as an opportunity to say, look at this, they're doing it because everything else that Obama has done has been a complete flop, and it is proof that the economy is in a ditch. Well, I mean, nobody needs proof of that. Everyone feels it all the time. They know that things aren't as good as they might be, and many people are struggling. So I think, once you get out of the hot bubble of the election, for most people, it's not a controversial thing.
I mean, indeed, yeah. If it was just any other day of the week, it probably wouldn't be, quite a story. But if you were to sort of flip onto the likes of CNBC, and I was sort of looking at Bloomberg as well. I mean, oddly, and maybe this also works in the administration's defense for the moment. I mean, so much of the focus is on what's happening in North Africa and the Middle East at the moment. But David, we're 1 week or 2 weeks, depending how you look at it, off the back of the Republican and Democratic conventions. If you look at just the state of the economy and where things sit right now, is that really still the key driver? Is that what's going to swing votes one way or the other? Or do you think now, when you have obviously a bubbling situation like this in the Middle East, that that foreign policy is also going to perhaps play more of a role than we thought even maybe 2 weeks ago?
Well, I do think that what's going on in the Middle East is very dangerous to President Obama. I mean, they're turning on their televisions here every night and seeing smoke rising from American embassies. It's not a good thing. And the Republicans are every day handing away the message that it is proof that Mr. Obama's foreign policy approach and his handling in particular of the Arab Spring has fallen apart. It hasn't yet really resonated. I mean, there's some new polls out today, and notably Wall Street Journal NBC poll, that, some see as a bit of a turning point because it points to Mr. Obama widening quite an important over Mr. Romney in swing states, Ohio, Virginia, and Florida. So none of this yet has begun to impinge on what actually seems to be growing from momentum for the president, not the other way around. But I'm not sure that's going to last very long unless today's Friday prayer protests are the worst of this. I mean, if things begin to calm down, then I think, the impact of all this may be limited. If it gets any worse, I think Obama might be in trouble. I should also say that he, as usual, is blessed by his opponents, because every time Mr. Romney sees an open window, he seems to manage to smash a couple of panes and he tries to go through it. He was widely criticized, including by many Republicans, for the fierce attack he launched on Obama, even before we learned of the death of Ambassador Stevens in Libya. And I think there is a sense that once again, you know, Romney has fumbled what should have been a perfect opportunity for him. But I think they're playing catch-up now, and this message that Obama's foreign policy is not what it should have been, you know, may begin to take hold, but it hasn't quite yet.
And David, just before we go, you are a gentleman and a correspondent who's been here a couple of times before, in that very seat ringside, you know, watching all of this unfold. And as we are, you know, I guess around the 2 month point, with people heading to the polls, you know, do you see, will it really have to be, you know, a series of, I mean, I know either this gets much worse in the Middle East and this, you know, becomes fuel for the Republicans, you know, to use against the current administration. Is it going to be on a wire, or do you think that people, you know, as you're saying, they're going to see sort of the bumbling and fumbling we've seen on the part of Mr. Romney, and, you know, it'll be not quite a cakewalk, but it'll be quite decisive in terms of the incumbent?
I think I would sort of hold my predictions until after the presidential debates, the first on the 3rd of October in Denver. And I would say also that, you know, whatever your broad instincts are about what's going to happen, and I have to say my broad instinct at the moment is that Mr. Obama will win, you know, you have to match that against what is happening in these very few states, the eight or nine swing states, and what is going on there with a very small number of undecided voters. So I think bets are still off. I think, as you say, outside events like what we're seeing now can have an influence. But I think absolutely critical will be those debates. And my experience with Mr. Romney is that he's not very good when the camera is close in. And Obama is, Mr. President Obama, on the other hand, it comes across as competent, and above all, he comes across as really meaning what he's saying. And I think Romney's real problem is that he's torn apart by a party that is being, you know, dragged to the right more than he would like. And there was a sense in Tampa that I felt that you never quite believed that he believed what he was saying. That's not something you get from President Obama. And I think President Obama will walk away with the debates, and I think that will seal the election. But let's see.
Great. David Osborne, the U.S. editor for The Independent in New York. Thanks very much for that. You're listening to Midori House. It is just, it's 18:22 here in London. It's 13:22 in Toronto. We're back in a moment.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Hong Kong, and Tokyo. As a Monocle 24.
Welcome to Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λόνδρεδο, Μπρούσελ, Monocle 24.
Λόντωστε Καζίν, τέμα on Monocle 24.
Λόντωμπο, as a Monocle 24.
Λόνδρεδο, Μπρούσελ, Monocle 24.
Λόντενιστ, είναι Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que que nina tira no ar, Monocle 24.
Αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24-tagat, ja.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Well, the media in France has always had a bit of a tumultuous relationship with the British royal family. Today, it has soured even further. The French celebrity magazine Closer has come under fire for publishing pictures of the Duchess of Cambridge sunbathing topless. But what's more surprising than the magazine's apparent disregard for French privacy laws is the way the international press have reacted to the photos. Much to discuss on this topic, and I am joined by France 24's London correspondent Bénédicte Pavia. Welcome.
Bonjour, hello.
How are you? You've been very busy.
I've been very busy with this story all day. The British media is going nuts about
it,
understandably, actually.
And, I mean, when this broke this morning, and I would just, maybe I'd love to start off, just how has France 24 actually been covering this? You know, would this have even been, you know, a lead item, or does it move up the news agenda, you know, based on just how it's being fueled on this side of the channel?
The latter is true. It's what's been happening. I think there is real concern, and obviously we are reporting on the big reaction, not only of the palace, but indeed of the British media, who are infuriated by the publication of these pictures by Closer, an English word, but pronounced in the French way because it's a French magazine. And let me rectify something. Many people didn't know who this magazine was owned by all day long and actually have studiously avoided saying who it is owned by. Well, apparently it used to be in part of a British group, EMAP.
EMAP, yeah.
But then it was sold off to an Italian company. Guess who owns it, Tyler?
I wonder.
The former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, who has been the object of many a paparazzi and a sex scandal in the past. So anyway, what is interesting, which has also emerged this afternoon, is that British newspapers were offered photographs last week, but they turned them down. And, of course, the comparison that... two comparisons are being made here. One is Kate going to be the new Diana? And it's interesting that in a London newspaper, the Evening Standard, there is a whole article on the fact that one of her ex-bodyguards, who was with her for 5 years, said, "We never had to deal with anything this bad. There was a good relationship, despite some, obviously, excesses at the time. But he really thinks that the palace needs to really brace itself, because he thinks he detected, when the Prince William married Catherine, that there was already this kind of interest, global interest in her. And really, I think it's tantamount to saying, you think you're having a private life or a private moment? You're not. Mm-mm. You never will again."
Is this more amplified because it's on French territory? If this had happened in the south of Spain, if this would have happened in Brazil, but the fact that this has happened on French territory and it's a French magazine, is it slightly more amplified, do you think?
Possibly, because there is anyway a love-hate relationship culturally with France. But of course, what is not lost on anybody is the fact that Diana, just over 15 years ago, was killed in a crash in a tunnel, Le Pont de l'Alma, Le Tunnel de l'Alma, and she was being chased by paparazzi at the time. And if there is, what is interesting also is to note and to speak to colleagues who are with William and Catherine out in Asia. And they learnt about this, so they were shown photos over their breakfast, which must have been highly indigestible, the breakfast and the pictures, I suggest. And it has gone from being a shocked reaction, to being incredulous, to being absolutely furious. And apparently William, who wants to protect his wife's privacy, is absolutely determined. And we've just learnt in the last hour that indeed the palace, who was considering taking legal action, has decided to take legal action. I think in two sentences, let me say that France has the strictest privacy laws on the planet, almost. But the problem is that whereas in the 1990s, Tyler, people got big fines, like €100,000, now they're down to about 30,000. There's a real problem. And there is an increasing celebrity magazine culture, even in France.
Does this story have a different weight because it happened in a magazine? It wasn't on someone's blog. And it's a discussion we've been having up on the editorial floor, you know, in an era when, you know, as you're saying, maybe also, you know, settlement claims come down because there's more out there.
But literally. There's
quite, yes. Quite. But the fact that it's actually still on paper and almost the commitment of putting ink on a page actually makes it worth a little bit more.
Interesting question and interesting discussion you've been having here at Monocle.
Very busy upstairs today.
Yes, it's not a question I've come across in the many interviews I've done today. I think that's a very interesting point of view. I think it's a mix of those answers. And let's remember that Closer, actually, as I've found out now, and I will plead guilty, I did not know this before this all happened today, is that Closer is both a magazine, which I understand sells about 414,000 copies a week, and which, of course, will be bought by people up and down France because they can probably resell it on eBay very quickly for a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yes, very healthy sales. So therefore, a small fine isn't going to be a big problem. But it's also on their website. Now, you do have to subscribe to the website. But I hear already, and in fact, I've been sent the pictures by somebody who thought that I might like to see them because they've been copied on an American website. So the problem that exists is, this is what has unleashed this fury, is that this woman, this young woman, 30-year-old wife, is going to become the Queen of England. Indeed, Clouseau shows off about the fact that she's the future Queen of England, that you've never seen her like that before, and you may never see her again.
Is there a Gaelic rallying around on the part of media that they will stand behind or beside Clouseau and say, yeah, this is, you know, this is the way it is, it's open season these days, or will we see the French dailies tomorrow perhaps distancing themselves and the discussion as broadcasts are on air or going on air in France right now? Where do you think people will end up and settle?
Possibly distancing themselves slightly, but the fact of the matter is, in France, having no top on and showing your breasts on a beach is just... It doesn't merit a second look, so to speak, unless you're that way inclined. So a relationship, a woman's relationship with her body is very different. And the Anglo-Saxon press does love to build women up a lot, and they love to tear them down. So there are two things that sell magazines. One is celebrities in the nude. That's what the celebrity magazine thrive on. And the second one is to have an intrusion into the British royal family, unlike any other royal family, the British royal family's private life, with Catherine's pictures today of her being in a private property in Provence for 3 days last week, having sun cream put on her by her husband. It's not illegal, it's not immoral. Of course, Clouseau has managed to do both, an intrusion in her privacy, and she's semi-nude.
And Dan, we have neither of those in Monaco. Bénédicte Pavillot, London correspondent for France 24. Bon weekend. Thank you very much.
Merci.
You're listening to Midori House, just the bottom of the hour here in London. We're back with the news headlines.
Desde Londres, esto es Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Od London, tu vas a Monocle 24.
De Londres, vous écoutez Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
位于伦敦,
London から.
From London,
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Desde Londres, esto es Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London,
this is Monocle 24.
1831, now 1832 here at Midori House in London. Coming up a little bit later in the program, I'm going to have my foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, and also our editor, Andrew Tucker, going to be here for the week in review in terms of major news stories. But before that, up-to-the-minute news with Bill Bingham.
Protests against a US film said to mock Islam have escalated in North Africa, the Middle East, the subcontinent, and the Far East. Demonstrators have attacked Western embassies in Tunisia and Sudan. In Khartoum, protesters entered the US compound, while the German and UK embassies were also attacked. There were clashes in Yemen and Egypt. In the Lebanese city of Tripoli, one person has been killed when demonstrators set fire to a KFC fast food restaurant. And hundreds of protesters in Pakistan have been burning American flags. Angry protesters have also been marching through Jordan's capital, Amman. Authorities in southern India have stepped up security after hundreds of anti-nuclear protesters escalated their fight against the country's largest Kudankulam nuclear power project. Demonstrators formed a human chain in waist-deep seawater, demanding an end to the loading of fuel in the plant. Protests intensified after the Supreme Court's decision against suspension of loading of fuel into the nuclear reactor. International lenders are likely to reach a final decision on the revised financing programme for Greece in the second half of next month. Inspectors from the so-called Troika of the International Monetary Fund, European Commission and ECB are in Athens to evaluate Greece's progress on agreed targets before releasing the next €32 billion from a €130 billion aid package. Wildcat strikers at Lonmin's Marikana mine have rejected a pay offer, dimming prospects of ending 5 weeks of industrial action that swept through South Africa's platinum sector and laid bare the power struggle in the ruling ANC. Workers on a rocky outcrop at the mine, where police shot dead 34 protesters last month, have dismissed the offer as way below the 12,500 rand a month, that's around $1,500, sought by members of the Militant Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union. The hole in the ozone layer, the Earth's protective shield against ultraviolet rays, is expected to be smaller this year over the Antarctic than last year. UN officials say it shows how a ban on harmful substances has stopped its depletion. But they say the hole is probably larger than in 2010, and a complete recovery is still a long way off. And that's the latest Monocle 24 news at the bottom of the hour.
Thanks very much for that, Bill. And there'll be more from you in about 26 minutes' time here on Monocle 24. Time for a little song right now. This is Sake by Jupiter. It up on a Friday afternoon here at Midori House in London. It's 18:37 here at Midori House in the heart of W1. We're going away for a short break, but our Ed Stocker from Buenos Aires is here when we come back. And welcome back to Studio One here at Midori House. Well, tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets of Argentina's largest cities on Thursday in protest against the policies of President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. Fernandez's approval rating has plummeted since her re-election last year as she tightened foreign exchange restrictions and broadened federal tax agency powers to investigate how people obtain and spend their money. The rallies yesterday were far more widespread than similar ones in June. And to tell us more, we have in studio our Buenos Aires correspondent, Ed Stock, just like the old days, like we had to fly you back, like with the big cans of film.
I know, it's
amazing how
it's good
happened.
To be back.
Well, welcome back. But is it just these current mechanisms that have people riled and have made it more widespread, or is there something sort of lingering beneath all of this, which is turning up the heat?
Well, I think the economy is slowing down massively. I think she was elected on a boom when the economy was doing really well. So I guess that kind of put aside some of the other problems, as it were. I think once the economy starts to slow, things aren't quite as rosy. People start to, I guess, question more things about the government. It's very easy for a government to stay popular if everything seems to be going well economically. And I guess it's been coupled with some, increasingly strict rules from the government. So a lot of people see this, her as being authoritarian. A classic taxi driver comment is that Argentina is becoming another Venezuela, which isn't true, by the way, but people fear that she's becoming more authoritarian or trying to meddle too much with people's lives. I guess
is part of this as well, the fact that whenever a government wants to look at tax in Argentina, does it really filter all the way up to the top? So, is this widespread because it's starting to impact the upper middle and upper classes as well?
Yeah, it's definitely becoming more widespread. I mean, Argentina's got a massive middle class. I think it's actually the largest middle class in South America. So obviously, if policies sting the middle class, it tends to mobilize more people than, say, in other Latin American countries. So that's sort of a unique thing that Argentina has. What's interesting about the Thursday protests is that they do seem to be growing in size. This isn't the first protest of this sort. They've been sort of growing steadily over the last couple of months, but it's certainly mobilized more people than usual. So that's interesting to see. Are we going to see more and more protests of this kind coming up over the next few months or years of her second mandate? Their midterms coming up in October of next year. So obviously, if she continues to plummet in popularity, we'll probably see that translated at the electorate as well. So,
Are there any good news stories? This is not just off the back of you coming back to London after the Olympics and all of these things, but there isn't a lot of sort of great that's coming out of the market. I've seen that Aerolíneas Argentinas have repainted their planes and are trying to give themselves a new coat of paint. They're talking up tourism, of course, etc., and trying to stimulate that sector of the market. But you're on the ground every day. I mean, what do you see there as certainly sort of the bright sparks that the country should be talking up and can point in some direction to economic recovery?
Well, obviously, as you were saying, tourism is a massive industry in Argentina.
Clearly, you like living there.
Indeed. It's got a lot to offer. Obviously, it doesn't quite have the financial clout of, say, neighbouring Brazil. Mm. So it doesn't have that to fall back on or to generate the same sort of income as Brazil can. In terms of its arts and its cultural market as well, that's always booming. So, I mean, that's an area that it can look to collaborate more on, I guess, internationally. So it's not all doom and gloom. And I have to add, too, that although the economy is slowing down, we're not heading for like a repeat of the 2002 economic crash. I mean, who knows? Maybe there'll be a deep recession, but nothing, massively severe.
And it does seem that part of it, too, is just, Argentina has historically just held this incredible position in Buenos Aires, really, being seen as almost the singular hub for such a long time. And of course, you go up the street and, the power of Sao Paulo, the power of not just Rio as a beach, but of also having the Olympics. And then I imagine it sort of irked people as well that the Colombians were also sort of making claim that theirs was, now the number two economy. After Brazil, and a few protests from Buenos Aires about that.
Well, yes, I mean, obviously they are people who lament, Argentina's faded glory and the good old days when it was booming. And there's a slight fatalism as well. People, because the country has tended to crash, several people I've talked to have this notion that every 10 years the country tends to have an economic crash. And so, yes, there's kind of fatalism amongst people from Buenos Aires, which is actually quite endearing in its own way, without wishing to sound too patronising. So I think people tend to be a bit negative about the economy and maybe downplay it. So I think, the country's going to be okay in the future.
Excellent. Ed Stocker, good to have you live and in Studio London. I'm sure we'll be hearing a little bit more from you here for about 2 weeks, I guess.
I am indeed.
Excellent. Have a good weekend. Thank you're listening you. To Midori House. We're going to be back in a moment.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London, W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wing Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And you're listening to Midori House. It's 1844 here in London. Well, as we head into the Jewish calendar's most holy period with Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur around the corner, what better time to pop into Marylebone's enormous West London Synagogue? Just up the road from Midori House, the synagogue was one of the first to head west when London's Jewish community was exclusively an East End affair. David Pleasant went to the temple this afternoon to meet the senior rabbi Julia Neuberger, who is also a baroness and one of two rabbis that sit in Westminster's House of Lords. She's rather busy woman, but welcome to Monocle into her synagogue.
I'm Julia Neuberger. I'm senior rabbi here at the West London Synagogue, and in part of my other life, I'm a member of the House of Lords. This congregation was founded in 1840, and it was a breakaway originally from one of the Orthodox synagogues in the East End, the Great Synagogue, and also from Bevis Marks, the big old Sephardi synagogue in the East End. And the people didn't want to walk 6 miles to services on the Sabbath, so they wanted a synagogue in the West End. And the powers that be in these synagogues decided they couldn't have one. And so they broke away and they set up their own synagogue. They set up their own synagogue originally in Euston, in, Cartwright Gardens, and then at some point, Burton Gardens. But in 1870, they built this absolutely magnificent building, which we're still using. And they have been part of the scenery of this part of London since 1870, very well known to neighbouring churches, very well known to neighbouring businesses, very well known to lots of the locals. And we have a lot of people who are not Jewish, but who have been to see the synagogue on various occasions and certainly been to services on various occasions. We engage in a whole variety of ways with people who live and work around here. Very particularly, we do various things with local churches, and for instance, we run a drop-in centre for refugees and asylum seekers, and some of the other churches are involved with us in that, and we're involved with the mosque in Regent's Park as well. We do a lot of interfaith activity, and that brings us into contact with all sorts of people. We do the London Clinic's regular annual service. There are all sorts of connections. We know the schools well, we speak in the schools come and visit. I think because we've been here such a long time, we're part of the furniture. And indeed, do you know what? I think that's the best way to be. So the synagogue is a really splendid building. It's built in what's called the Italian Moorish style. And the only synagogue remotely like it otherwise is in Florence, in Italy. It is quite dark, lots of plush red velvet. It has a very beautiful dome, which was bombed during the war and used to be painted. And the money it would have cost to repaint the dome as it was, we used instead to help the children who had survived the concentration camp. So it's never been properly repainted again. I think it's rather beautiful. It has these rather splendid marble pillars, which a variety of novelists have actually written about. And if anybody has ever read Amy Levy, she wrote a book called Reuben Sacks. And in Reuben Sacks, there is a description of some men leaning against the pillars of this very synagogue.
And that was Senior Rabbi Julia Neuber, part of our Meet the Neighbor series here at Midori House on Monocle 24. It is Friday afternoon. There's about 12 minutes until we go off air. And I'm joined by our editor, Andrew Tuck, and our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. I haven't seen you for a whole week.
No.
You missed the good event that we had last Thursday in Zurich.
Yes, I
you were invited. Steve, you weren't, but I don't know why. But anyway.
I missed the retail outing. Yeah, we have a kind of seasonal store. Is it seasonal?
It's seasonal, and not to mention, just beyond these walls, there's a very busy sale going on right now as well.
There is. There's been lots of people sort of running past and almost coming into the radio studio.
Yeah.
There was a woman with a bag who was like, oh, is it this way? I was like, no, I don't think so.
Yeah, it's just for our listeners and anyone who wants to swing down tomorrow, it is our seasonal, should we call it a clearance sale? It is kind of a clearance sale because the basement's looking like a bit of a tip. Anyway, let's talk about the weekend news.
Well, one of the reasons we haven't seen you is because you've been bouncing around the world. So this is normally a bit where you ask us what the news headlines are around the world. So should we quickly turn the tables? And as you've...
All the markets that I've been to this week.
No, but what were the one or two things, were there one or two stories that stood out when you travelled around the world? You thought, actually, this is a good story that we need to be covering here on Monocle 24.
Well, it was interesting from just when we had Benedict Pavillon on from France 24 talking about, obviously, these images in Closer, as she liked to call it, or Closer magazine. For all other listeners, I was in Sydney on Monday, and the Aussie papers were filled over the weekend. On Monday, a lot of the media pages about Australian Consolidated Press, the biggest glossy magazine publisher in Australia, being taken over by the Germans. And it's one of these sort of classic Anglo-Saxon stories about, in the same way that when we saw, any foreign media companies coming to these shores in the UK, but just the idea that the Germans would suddenly descend on really what is probably, the jewel in the crown of Australian publishing and has now been taken over by the Bauer family. And what does this mean, et cetera, et cetera. And so a lot of people are sort of, asking, my opinion about that. It was a huge sort of dinner table conversation, but I think it's good news for them because the current owners were not particularly interested in it, and Bauer largely know what they're doing, and they're sending down actually one of the family members to look after the thing as well.
Because we've slightly touched on it before, but it is an amazing media story that this was the magazine market. I had the highest sales of magazines per capita I think anywhere in the world. But it has been a bit kind of shaky in recent years.
Well, and that's what's interesting. We look at Australia. We've been talking a lot about the whole Fairfax story and many journalists storming out from the likes of The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald and a huge question mark as to what's going to happen to those papers. The Australian actually making some quite interesting moves. So, you do see, healthy competition and, you do see a degree of innovation. But I think, Andrew, your point is really interesting because a lot of people said, we shouldn't forget the fact that this is a magazine-loving market. market. And it actually probably took some, you know, some deep pockets, some private money out of Germany to recognize this, because everyone's, you know, been looking at TV networks and everything else in Australia. And then actually, just as I was going around the region as well, I was in Singapore Airport, picked up another magazine called August. There's a men's edition. There's now a women's edition. And I thought, oh, okay, who publishes this? Berta publishes it. So it's amazing to actually see these private German publishers, you know, either just going into these markets and launching, or, you know, at, you know, I guess at a time when you sort of don't sort of think about sort of the German establishment sort of being active outside of Europe, but they're definitely making inroads to Asia. But anyway, enough about my time in the Asia Pacific. Steve, what would you, where do you want to start in terms of a week in review? Should we, are we going to stick close to home in terms of day's events, or should we rewind a bit further?
I think let's stick to, I mean, what you started the show on, because it has become, I mean, it has been the big story of the week. And just how a film that doesn't even exist, and frankly, the suggestion of something bad made by someone somewhere can prompt such outrage, I think is depressing and fascinating in equal measures. One thing I think is worth pointing out, though, the protests, I'm loath to call them protests, because protesters usually, you know, they have banners and they chant and they, but these are attacks.
They don't burn chancery.
Exactly. The numbers that we're talking about here, although it's many, many cities across the region, across the Middle East and almost elsewhere as well, are remarkably small compared to the numbers that you've seen protesting against governments, whether that's in Yemen or even in Khartoum recently, or, of course, the numbers that we saw in the mass protests in Tunisia, in Libya, in Egypt during the Arab Spring. I think that's quite important to point out. This isn't, you know, the Arab winter, and this is sort of the counter-revolution of sort of, you know, Islamism coming back, as you know, really strongly. It's the numbers involved are very small.
Let's have a clip from a little bit earlier in the week. This was Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on the embassy storming in Libya.
We lost four Americans. They were good and brave men. They were committed to the cause of building a brighter future for the people of Libya. And we condemn the violence in the strongest terms, the violence against our posts in Benghazi, in Egypt, and now in Yemen.
That was Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Andrew, earlier on, we were talking to David Anderson from Oxford University, and then we also had David Osborne as well, the Independent's U.S. editor. And, you know, I was asking both of them, you know, at the start of the program, you know, in part, you know, what does this mean for the current administration as well? And there's something just, the way Secretary of State Clinton starts off, but the death of four Americans, you know, at a time when, of course, everyone is looking at popularity rankings between the Republicans and Democrats. David, does this come back to bite them? Was there something there? Was there a failing of security? Was there a failing on the part of Marines looking after that consulate that is going to come back and bite this administration?
I think they were certainly wrong-footed. I think they felt, certainly in Libya, they'd been there to help topple the Gaddafi regime. They felt quite welcome, I would imagine. But it certainly seems that, you know, just as we're seeing in Afghanistan, every time you see a government there or a police body, there's always somebody internally who's working for the opposition. And the way that the safe house was revealed so quickly, it just makes you realize that there's still very strong factions playing there. But I think what's more interesting for the Americans is, on a geopolitical level, is how this plays out with the bigger countries like Egypt. You know, there Morsi, he didn't rush to kind of, you know, say that this was wrong to attack the embassy. You know, he did it all in his own time. He said it was right that people should be allowed to protest if they wanted. And I think the Americans have been blunt. You know, they would like to point out to, and I'm sure they're doing this behind the scenes, we pay your bills. You know, we give you a huge amount of cash. Egypt would not be ticking along as it is even now in any sense if it wasn't for the Americans. You start protecting our embassy, or there's going to be, you know, there's going to be cash missing off the table in the future.
Is that the biggest lever they have, Steve?
Cash, yes, to a certain extent. But also, I think there's it's interesting to look at the Muslim Brotherhood as they have gone from being a very popular but an underground opposition movement to running a country. in a remarkably short period of time, and you're seeing them struggle in public as to how to make that change. And Mohamed Morsi might be president of Egypt, but he's not necessarily even the most powerful person within the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. He was the person put forward as the candidate. So it's you have this little struggle. And it's interesting, as Andrew says, you know, his first instinct was, first of all, to say nothing. And then when he did decide to say something, it was saying how terrible the film was. And he had to be called by Obama and say, no, mate, you can't just say that. You've got to remember that we're giving you a lot of money and you've got to protect our embassy. And finally, he's like, oh, yes, sorry. We strongly condemn attacks on, you know, these are our guests, we shouldn't do that. So that's difficult for them. I think when you look at the politics of the situation with the election coming up, Mitt Romney somewhat foolishly stepped in to criticise the Obama administration for some statements that have been made before the attack started by the Egypt embassy, by the US embassy in Egypt. And they've been now unsure about whether do we step away from that or do we double down. And just yesterday you've had Rich Williamson, who is Romney's one of Romney's main foreign policy advisers, and a man who should know better because he worked for the Bush administration in Sudan. He was the Bush's envoy on Darfur, so knows about how you have to engage with Arab countries and how you go about that. Saying quite bluntly, you know, if Romney was president, you know, these people would still be alive.
Gentlemen, just before we go, we've got about 35 seconds or so. Andrew, how long does this go on? I mean, is this, you know, not unlike the Danish cartoon story? And of course, you know, Denmark was very different. But is this something which is going to take, you know, a week, 10 days to get a lid on it? Or, you know, is it out of the news? Not quite out of the news, but is it sort of wrapped up by Monday, do you think?
I don't think it has incredibly long legs. Actually, the great thing is people tire of throwing petrol bombs and they want to go home at the end of the day. And I think also there's no real story here. People almost don't know what they're kind of, you know, throwing rocks about in some senses.
And yeah, you look at the cartoon, the people in cartoon thinking, oh, we'll attack the German embassy because it's right here. I mean, it's nonsensical. You know, this was the big day. It was Friday after prayers. There were small protests, but I don't think it's going to go much further.
Great. Steve Bloomfield, Andrew Tuck, thanks for that. That's all the time we have for today. Our studio producer was Dawn Trump, and Daniel Giacopelli was also in the mix as well. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Up next, we have the news with Bill Bingham. And then after that, it's going to be this week's edition of The Menu. We'll hear a report about the increasing use of offal by head chefs in Berlin. Tomorrow, shameless plug right now, Dawn Trump and also our Adrian Craddock are very busy right now working on tomorrow's edition of The Stack. That is at 10 a.m. London time. And of course, after that, it's the noon review. That's all for today. Have a good weekend. Goodbye.